Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Who We Are podcast. And today I have a very special guest with me, Rolf. Rolf, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. You have been described as one of the sharpest thinkers of our time. Someone who doesn't just dissect human decision-making, but also fundamentally challenges the way we approach successes, happiness, and productivity. Your books, The Art of Thinking Clearly, and your latest book, The Not-To-Do List, have influenced millions, urging us to think more critically, act more wisely, and also perhaps more importantly, unlearn the habits that quietly sabotage our lives. Today, we're going beyond conventional wisdom to explore not just how to do more, but how to do less better. Welcome on the show, Rolf.
I'm not the smartest person.
Well, you have been described for sure as one of the sharpest thinkers of all time, and I am so grateful to have you with us today. But before we dive into cognitive biases, decision making, and the power of not doing, I'd love to start on a personal note, you know, if that's possible. You've spent years distilling complex ideas into practical wisdom. But what's one not-to-do habit that you still struggle with in your own life?
Oh, my big one is overconfidence. Overconfidence is a typical human trait. I have it probably a little bit stronger than other people. It's not a rational thing. Overconfidence means we think we are smarter than we are. We think we are faster than we are. We think we are quicker and more efficient than we actually are. And then it usually turns out we don't achieve what we all try to achieve in a day. Take a simple example. A lot of people do to-do lists for the day. You know, these are the 10 things I want to do today, or I aim to do this day. And how often does it happen when you really get all the things done that you promised yourself to do? It never happens. So, and the funny thing is we don't learn from this. So we don't adapt to the next day and only put 5 things on the list instead of 10. And I have the same problem. I grapple with this all the time. I always think I'm faster than I am with a certain project. I know more than I do. And then I run into reality. So overconfidence is a really, really big issue I still grapple with.
Well, thank you for sharing so honestly. And, you know, before we dive deeper also into the books, the amazing books that you've written, I wanted to understand more also on your personal philosophy. What personal experiences or perhaps, you know, pivotal moments in your life led you to explore decision-making and cognitive biases as central themes in your work?
So, about 15 to 20 years ago, some scientists in the psychology space in the US and in Israel, they started to work on cognitive biases. It was a fringe movement in psychology, in the psychology research. People realized that human beings are not rational. We have flaws. We are irrational, but in a certain way. We're not just irrational once to the right, once to the left, but we know in which direction we are irrational. And people like Danny Kahneman, and who got the Nobel Prize in 2002, and Amos Tversky, they started working on these things. John Gilovich, you have Richard Thaler, who later got the Nobel Prize. They started working on these things. It was a real fringe movement at the beginning, but I was kind of fascinated with that research. And I was looking for a book that would give me kind of short summaries of all these cognitive biases, of all these, sometimes it's called heuristics, sometimes it's called cognitive biases, sometimes it's called thinking errors. It's all the same. It's deviations from logic. Deviations from the logical way how we should, in theory, work and think. So I started collecting these things, and I saw that nobody else is doing it. So I started collecting it for myself. I told friends about this collection of notes. They said, why don't you write a newspaper column? So I eventually wrote a newspaper column about this in Germany and in Switzerland. And then this got translated into a book. And then the book got translated in several languages. And it was kind of the first book that summarizes all these things. It's kind of an encyclopedia of these thinking errors. It was the first book that came out. Later on, a lot of books came out, but it was the first one with kind of a short checklist of all these systematic thinking errors. But if you know those 99 or 100 systematic thinking errors, you're already on a good way.
Wow. And, you know, among the many cognitive biases, which one do you believe is the most destructive in today's world? And how can we guard against that?
So one is the sunk cost fallacy. At the sunk cost fallacy, you see that a lot in companies and businesses, but you see it in the small scale.
Oh, privately. Even in relationships.
Even in relationships. So you invest a lot of time or money into something, which turns out to be the wrong thing. Then you tell yourself, now I invested so much time in this relationship, I can't break it off. But if it's the wrong relationship, it's better to break it off. If it's really the wrong relationship, sometimes it seems wrong, but it could be salvaged. But if it's the wrong relationship, it's better to cut it. Or you are doing a university course or study, but after 2 years, you see that it's the wrong thing to do for yourself. Mm. But people then continue, I need to finish the degree because I've already invested 2 years of my time in this. But if it's the wrong thing to do, it's better to stop it and do the right thing. Or we've already invested $2 million in this marketing approach, this marketing campaign. If it turns out to be the wrong one, it's better to cut it and not to continue with the justification. Oh, we already invested $2 million. We can't stop it now. Or in the stock market, you buy a stock, it starts to tank, it goes down. And then you tell yourself, ooh, should I sell it now or should I keep it? But I've already lost so much money with it, so I'd rather not sell it. That's the wrong idea. You have to look at now what is the probability that the stock will go up or down, no matter what you paid for it. And that difference is called sunk costs. Sunk costs are costs in times of money that you cannot get back. And they should not play a role in your decision making. But funny enough and wrongly enough, they play a role in our brain. That's just how our brains are structured. So that's a big one. Reciprocity is another one where you can get manipulated into something. So some person gives you something, then you think you have to give something back, and people can be manipulated in this. So a lot of marketing material, they'll send you something, a sample or a piece of chocolate. I don't know how it is in Asia, but you see that a lot in Europe. And then you feel unconsciously obliged to give something back, to sign up for the service or to give time or to send money. So this reciprocity thing is kind of a tricky one because it's very deep ingrained in our brain. It's hardwired. All of those 100 systematic thinking errors are hardwired in our brains. But it's things we have to be careful of if you want to be free of this manipulation.
Yeah. And, you know, like, for example, your point on reciprocity, I think in order for relationships to work, whether at work or in our personal lives, a healthy level of reciprocity is needed to perhaps, you know, build a positive relationship. What are your thoughts? And how do we
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah. How do we know, you know, at which point is it, manipulative, like you said?
Yeah. So in a sales aspect, if a company comes to you or you have a big budget as, CEO of a company, and then some sales executive comes to you and invites you for a big fine lunch or a big fine dinner, there I would be very, very careful because he wants to invite you to that dinner and then you feel obliged to then give them a contract, give them the business. If it's relationship, that's absolutely built on the tit for tat. And that works. And that has been the human condition for millions of years. So this really works. And that's why we are so good at cooperating. We as human beings are so good at cooperating. But when it comes to big money, chunks of money, then be super careful. I would never accept an invitation to a dinner from somebody who wants a contract from me. Never. I want to look at the contract and then decide to do it or not to do it. And then once it's signed, I can have dinner with the person, but not before.
Got it. Well, that's very clear. Well, Rolf, I hope, you know, if you ever come to Singapore again, if I ask you out for a meal, you know, you would...
Okay.
that's... No, okay, I get that. It's clear. Wow. So in a sense, you don't want to owe a favor to someone. Is that right?
That's right. Unless it's, you know, people I already know and people I trust and people are friends. But if it's somebody new, I always pay.
I also want to talk about your book, The Not-To-Do List, and congratulations on this success, you know. In this book, you specifically use inversion to offer advice by highlighting what not to do. Why do you believe this approach is more impactful than traditional self-help methods?
Yeah, so traditional self-help methods, and that's 99% of all the books out there, they tell you what you absolutely have to do. So you have to go jogging for 30 minutes every day, then you
Wake
have to do 20 minutes of 5 a.m. You have to do 20 minutes of meditation, you have to take tea, pills and vitamins, and it just adds stuff you have to do. I believe that it's better to think to understand that if we decrease the negative stuff in our lives, the upside will take care of it. So instead of working on the upside, what makes me more successful, what makes me happier and so on, rather think of what destroys success and what destroys happiness and remove this stuff out of your life. And the idea came to me from a guy who unfortunately died while I was writing the book, but he became a good friend of mine. His name is Charlie Munger. He was a very, very wise person. He died almost just before his 100th birthday when I was writing the book. He is the business partner of Warren Buffett, who is the most successful investor of all times. And Charlie is a very, very wise person. And he hasn't written a book, but he has given speeches. And one speech he gave was in 1986, a long time ago. At Harvard School, not the Harvard University near Boston, but the Harvard School in Los Angeles. And he gave a talk, a so-called commencement speech. These are the speeches that, you know, some famous person from that school comes and tells all the graduate students, this advice, this you have to do in your life, and then you're going to be successful. And Charlie turned this around and he said, I'm going to give you a couple of things that totally destroy your life, guaranteed. Just don't do those things. And I thought this is a good approach of giving them negative advice, and then you can avoid this, and then the upside will take care of itself. Life will turn out to be good if you don't do these things. So one advice that Charlie had and that I also incorporated in my book is be unreliable. So there are, and then of course, don't do that. So there are a lot of people I see in life who are very smart, who have grades from the best universities, who have, who come from the right families, the right zip codes, who have everything right, but they're not reliable. And I see them and you can observe them throughout life. And at the beginning, everything goes well. And then sometimes they crash, or mostly they crash because of their unreliability. Eventually people just stop doing work with them. They stop doing business with them. They don't want to interact with them because they're unreliable. On the other hand, I see a lot of people who are not the smartest, who didn't have the best grades, who didn't go to the best universities, who don't come from the best families, who don't have the best genes, who are not the prettiest, who are not the fastest, but they are totally reliable throughout their lives. And those guys have success in life. Maybe not become billionaires, but they have a good life, a stable, good, successful life. So reliability is a really, really big chunk, and it's totally underrated in today's society because it doesn't sound sexy to tell somebody just be reliable and your life's going to be good. That's not a sexy proposition, but it's a very, very important, very, very important ingredient of a successful. So did this whole thing of unreliability remove that? And that was one of Charlie Munger's ones also. So I had collected hundreds of these things over the past couple of years of things that you should not do, stuff that are on the not to do list.
Yes.
And I've compiled a couple in this book, the not to do list.
I love that. You know, thank you for bringing reliability up, because I remember in your book, you talk about reliability versus genius. And you argue that reliability is more important than brilliance. And if I can pick out a couple more that really jumped out at me from your not-to-do list that perhaps you can talk through with us, one of which is also quitting versus persevering. Rolf, you know, I also believe that I think one of the most important decisions we have to make in life, besides deciding who we choose to spend the rest of our lives with, is to also know when to persevere, when to pull the plug, or when to push through. And I think a lot of times, you know, the advice, don't give up, is too simplistic. So how can we discern when to quit versus when to persevere? And for yourself, what criteria or advice for criteria do you personally use to make this decision?
The key point before you even come to that decision is, what kind of goals do you have in life? So you have to be clear about your goals. If those goals are not clear, you will have no way of deciding whether you should continue or not continue with a certain thing. But like we talked about, the sunk cost fallacy. If it's the wrong thing to do, it's better to quit early and give up and change course. So the main point, and that it always starts with your life decisions, what do you want to achieve with your life? And that is something that is also a lot of times misunderstood. Some people have crazy ideas about life outcomes or life goals. What goals you set is dependent on the skills you have, your innate skills. You can have life goals that don't fit your skills. Maybe you're not sporty, but you want to become the next Roger Federer in tennis playing. That's probably a wrong life goal. So you have to look at your skills. And here, Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, they set up this circle of competence idea. A circle of competence is where your skills are above average. Ideally, you want to be in that circle of competence, the best in the world, in that small circle. It's not important how big that circle is, but it's important that you know where that circle ends. So you have to look at your life and see and check, where have I been better than the average person? Much better than the average person. And that gives you a good hint that this could lead you into a life goal. That's an exercise. It takes half an hour out of your life. You should do it. You should define your circle of competence and then try to be the best person in that circle of competence, because that's the only way how you're going to be really, really material successful in your career. And once you have set those life goals, then you can deduct, you know, where should I invest my time? What should I consume in terms of media and so on? A lot of things flow out of that exercise of defining your circle of competence. So it fits, if it fits your circle of competence.
Yeah.
And that's really your circle of competence. You've done that little exercise and going back in your life. Where reliably are you better than average? If this is your circle of competence, you just don't quit. You just continue on.
You soldier
through all the way. But if this doesn't fit your circle of competence, i.e. it doesn't fit your life goals, then you give up and change course. So don't hang on to something and trying to do something where you have no chance of achieving the status of the best person in the world to do that specific thing. So it's very important first to start with the goals, and then everything else flows out of it.
Got it. That's very clear. If productivity is often framed today as the ultimate virtue, why do you argue against structured days and to-do lists in the book? And how can we and how should we rethink productivity?
So to-do lists, you know, these daily things that you add, you know, these 10 things you want to do in your life, that doesn't make sense, again, because of the overconfidence issue, because we didn't really plan it through. So the way to do it is to plan a day of saying, okay, I'm estimating this task is going to take me 2 hours, and then you have to put it in the calendar. And then you take the next task, the next important task, and say, how long is this going to take? Okay, this is going to take me 3 hours. Where I'm going to place it in the calendar? And then once you estimate the times to those to-dos and you place it into your daily calendar, you see that you can't achieve everything that you want to do. So you have to really plan it out. And then the stress also goes away, because then you have then you have it in there, and you're getting outside of that hustle culture of just powering through a million things at the same time. You do step by step, and you really reserve enough time to do it. The stress goes away. I think you're more productive if you have less stress. Life is better without chronic stress. So put it in the calendar and then do it. People forget the calendar thing. They just do to-do lists, but that's wrong.
Mm. Yeah. And on this note also, I would love to ask, you know, Rob, how do you manage your own expectations in life? Because in your book, you talked about having high expectations and believing that setting high expectations is a recipe for misery. So how do you manage your own expectations in life?
So people always confuse wishes and expectations. So I have a lot of wishes in my life.
Yeah.
Wishes are like clouds somewhere up in the sky. And that's great. It's beautiful to have wishes. And I wish a lot of things for my life. But they shouldn't translate directly into expectations. Expectations is something harder. Expectations, if they're met or not met, they generate a reaction in your body. They generate, if you don't meet them, they generate stress. Your body secretes glucocorticoids. That's unhealthy. You become sad or angry or whatever. So it turns into emotions. So first step is we separate wishes, and you can have a lot of wishes from expectations. Expectations, you have to be very careful. Mm. It's generally better to have lower expectations than higher expectations. Then you cannot be disappointed. If I have a goal in my mind of doing something or of achieving something, what is my expectation that this thing is going to happen? From zero expectation to 10, very high expectations. I usually estimate, like say, number 8, quite a high expectation. And then I subtract 2 or 3 points from that. And I set this as my expectation. So it's generally better to go with low expectations through life. You have less disappointment. You have less stress in your life. You can have the wishes as much as you want. That's great. But expectations, keep it low. And in a relationship, that's very important. Mm. People usually have expectations that are way too high towards the other person. And what's even worse, the other person towards you. So you have to make sure those expectations are quite low, because then you meet those expectations or exceed them, and everybody is happy in the relationship. If you get into a relationship and your expectations are too high, that relationship is going to crumble. It's not a healthy thing to have high expectations. This is married to that problem with the overconfidence. It's the same mental circuit, the expectations and the overconfidence. It's better to go with low expectations through life. And then do still the best. I mean, do the best you can. And then be positively surprised. I try to go through life with zero expectations. So that would be the end state. That would be the wise person. I'm not there yet, but the wise person, I believe, goes through life with zero expectations. You always give, of course, your best.
Yes.
You see what comes out. A lot of it is outside of your control.
And you hope for the best.
A lot of things you can. You hope for the best. That's hope. That's the clouds. You can hope for the best. And you see what comes out. But try to go through life with zero expectations. That will actually be my ideal state of being. I'm not there yet.
I love that. I love that. And the way you framed it in this book, it really also gets us to, you know, stop in our tracks, to rethink perhaps, you know, the way we have been cruising through life without even pausing to think, you know, does this really serve us or benefit us? But the other thing, you know, that you wrote in your book, which I think is somewhat provocative, is stop reading the news. And in a world where staying informed is often equated with responsible citizenship or being knowledgeable, why do you advocate for cutting out news entirely? Not even like decreasing, but entirely cut it out.
Yeah. So news is a problem in a lot of different ways. And I've written a book about this, and it's called Stop Reading the News. That's the title of the book. So I was a news junkie in the past. Long, long time ago. And then eventually I realized that, you know, I've consume these thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of news, I ask myself two questions. Question number one is, do I make better decisions for my life or my company or my friends or in the relationship if I've read a piece of news as opposed to not having that piece of news? And I couldn't think of one piece of news that really helped me make better decisions for my life out of these tens of thousands of news pieces that I've consumed. And the other question that I ask myself is, at least do I understand the world better by having consumed these tens of thousands of news pieces? And also there I had to say, no, I don't really understand the world better. I understand the world better if I read a book that really goes deep into a subject, or if I read really long articles, which is not news, but these are really long, long pieces, or if I talk to people who really know, to experts or people who really know the subject, then I learn something and I understand the world better. But consuming news gives you the illusion that you understand the world better. It gives you the illusion of knowledge, but you don't really understand the world better. So I decided to cut out the news completely. And I've done this for more than 10 years. I hadn't consumed news. Now, because I'm on a different level, I sometimes have to moderate a couple of talks with experts on geopolitics. I'm reading about 5 minutes news per day, but I keep it at 5 minutes, not more. Absolute minimum. But it's much healthier also for the body. News gives you a stress reaction because most news are negative. That's deliberate. The world is not negative to 80%. And only 20% positive. There's a lot of positive things out there in the world. But then when you consume news, you have the impression that the world is mostly negative. There's a war here and there is tariffs coming from Donald Trump. But there's, you know, a million bad things. But that's not the world. That's the news media, because the brain is attracted to negative stories. We jump on it much faster so the media can sell us subscriptions and advertising to it. It's a business model of the media to have that negativity bias, it's called in media terms. It's a negativity bias. So it's best to cut out the news or to really reduce it to 5 minutes per day. You will not miss anything big. People are always afraid that, oh, if I stop reading the news, something will come around the corner and it's going to be really bad. And if I haven't prepared myself, nothing has ever happened that you didn't hear. And if something really important happens, you will hear it from your friends in due time.
We are so blessed to be able to, you know, read both of your books. And what do you hope your readers take away from, let's say, two of these books? And how do you want your legacy as a thinker or writer to be remembered?
Well, I don't worry about legacy. So I don't really care what people think about me in 20 years or in 50 years. Probably nothing. I'll be forgotten. That's okay. There's other people on the stage who will write books or who will bring ideas into the world. What I hope to do is give people give people a sense of how to choose targets, goals, life goals better, of going through life in a more conscious way, of sometimes take a step back and think, oh, you know, this decision, you know, let me sleep over it. Let me think over it. There are these biases, or maybe one bias is influencing me. So just take a step back, go more consciously through life than by just copying everybody else and just be super busy like everybody else. That's my goal. You know, the quality of your life depends really on two things. One is the quality of your thoughts. Number two is the quality of your relationships. Once you have these things set, you're fine. So, and my books work on the number one, on the quality of your thoughts. I want to have the quality of your, of my thoughts, you know, at a high level. And once I have the quality of my thoughts at a high level, I think I have a good life. I can go through life without being pulled into the craziness of the world.
Rolf, as we wrap up, I want to ask you, if you could have a billboard down the streets of like New York, Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, around the world, what would your billboard say and why?
I would come back to this. Actually, it's a beautiful question. Thanks for framing it that way, Rachel. That's a good way of thinking about it. I would say I would say these two things that I mentioned, the quality of your life depends on the quality of your thoughts and the quality of your relationships. And that's it. That should be on that billboard.
Beautiful.
And not the quality of how much money you have, not whether you become vice president of something, big corporation, not if you have a billion followers on some social media platform, not that you're the prettiest person in the world. That all doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. The quality of your thinking, the quality of your thoughts, and the quality of your relationship, that's what counts.
Well, Rolf, well, thank you so much for this insightful chat, and thank you for bringing your wisdom to us through this conversation, through all your other conversations, and also through your amazing work. For those of us who want to continue to follow you and your work, where can we find you since you're not on social media?
Well, you find me in the books. So yeah. I have my you're books. There. I'm not on social media, no.
No, thank you so much, Rolf, and thank you for taking the time to speak with all of us.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It was a real pleasure. And thanks to all the listeners and readers of my book. Thank you so much.